Chief Justice, may it please the court.
I'm Giancarlo Conoparo.
I'm Zach Smith.
And welcome to SCOTUS 101, where we break down what's happening at the Supreme Court, what the justices are up to,
and other things related to our favorite branch of government.
Welcome back to another episode of SCOTUS 101. Things are finally heating up at the court as the justices return to begin their final oral argument sitting for the term, and they also handed down several decisions. But first, GC, is there anything interesting on the orders front this week?
Yes, there is. In Labrador versus Poe, the court stayed the injunction against enforcement of Idaho's Vulnerable Child Protection Act. That means that Idaho's ban on sex change surgeries and hormone treatments for children remains in effect. The case is still in its early stages, and this was only a preliminary move, so the litigation remains ongoing. But the order was noteworthy because the justices engaged in a discussion about the propriety of nationwide injunctions, which the injunction against Idaho's act was. Now, those are injunctions that purport to bind everyone in the country, not just the parties to the lawsuit. They have come under withering criticism, both from some justices, judges, and scholars. These injunctions now have three justices who oppose them outright, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, two who express skepticism, Kavanaugh and Barrett, two who said that this injunction didn't qualify, that's Jackson and Sotomayor, but critically, they were not willing, in this opinion at least, to defend nationwide injunctions, and two justices who are silent on the topic, which are Roberts and Kagan.
Very interesting. Well, the court also returned to hear oral arguments this week, and we'll focus on one very briefly. It's the case of Fisher versus United States. In this case, the court heard arguments involving the case of Joseph Fisher, who's prosecuted for his involvement January 6th under a federal statute that forbids corruptly obstructing an official proceeding. Fisher challenged this charge, and the district court originally dismissed it. But a divided panel of the D.C. Circuit reversed and reinstated the charge, so Fisher asked the Supreme Court to review it. Now, generally, at oral argument, the justices appeared skeptical of the government's broad reading of this statute, which was originally passed in the wake of the Enron financial scandal to prohibit tampering with evidence that would later be used in an official proceeding. Justice Gorsuch asked the government whether outbursts in court that required it to adjourn and reconvene or pulling a fire alarm would qualify as federal felonies under this statute that would subject someone to potentially up to 20 years of imprisonment. Alito piggybacked on these questions and asked whether disruptions in the Supreme Court's proceedings would qualify for prosecution under this statute. And frankly, the government, I didn't think, had very convincing answers to these questions. But taking a step back, more importantly, in some sense, this case has important implications for Jack Smith's prosecution of Donald Trump. Jack Smith has charged Trump under this same statute with obstructing and impeding the electoral vote certification in Congress. If the court narrows the scope of this statute in the Fisher case, it could make Smith's prosecution of Trump on those counts nearly impossible, if not outright impossible.
Oh, fascinating. Well, that brings us to opinions, and I'll start with DeVillier versus Texas. This was a unanimous decision by Justice Thomas, holding that a landowner can bring a Fifth Amendment takings claim against his state through a cause of action provided under that state's law if one exists. So in this case, Texas built a highway median, and it flooded a landowner's land. After the landowner filed federal and state takings claims in state court, Texas did something somewhat sneaky. It removed the case to federal court, where it moved to dismiss on the grounds that a plaintiff has no cause of action arising directly under the takings clause. In other words, that the takings clause is not self-executing. Texas won in the lower courts, but the Supreme Court reversed, holding that although constitutional rights do not typically come with built-in causes of action, where there is a state law cause of action, a plaintiff must be permitted to bring his takings claim under it. So this leaves for another day the core question, which is whether the takings clause is in fact self-executing.
Very interesting. Next up was Rudisill versus McDonough. This was an opinion authored by Justice Jackson, where the court held that James Rudisill, an Army veteran, could access his post-9/11 GI benefits without being subject to a statute's durational limit on those benefits. Now, this case delved into the distinctions and some of the intricacies of veterans' benefits law, but essentially the court held that Rudisill would be entitled to more generous GI benefits because of his multiple periods of service in the U.S. Army. But what was interesting and important in this case, I thought, was Justice Brett Kavanaugh's concurrence, which was joined by Justice Barrett. Justice Kavanaugh wrote separately to question the continued use of something called the Veterans Canon of Statutory Interpretation, which essentially says that veterans' benefits laws should be construed very generously to the benefit of veterans. Now, I don't think veterans receiving very generous benefits is something any of us would dispute or begrudge. I certainly hope we wouldn't. But Justice Kavanaugh was making the point, I think, that those types of determinations are better left to Congress. And so he said that in a future appropriate case, the court should review this particular veterans canon of statutory interpretation or any benefits related canon that favors one group over others. This is something very important and something I think we should keep an eye on in future cases.
And last up for this week, Muldrow versus the City of St. Louis. This was another unanimous decision, this time by Justice Kagan, holding that an employee challenging a job transfer under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act must show that the transfer caused some harm with respect to an identifiable term or condition of employment, but that the harm need not be significant. This case involved a female police officer who alleged that she was transferred from one unit to another simply because of her sex. She lost in the lower courts because the transfer, and I'm quoting from the lower court opinion, did not result in a diminution of her title, salary, or benefits and caused only minor changes in working conditions. The Supreme Court reversed, holding that the text of Title VII requires that a transferred employee show some sort of harm, but it doesn't require that the harm be significant or important or in any sort of modified by any sort of term. So although it was unanimous, there were three concurring opinions which took very different approaches. Justice Thomas was not convinced that the lower court actually applied the wrong standard. It seemed to him that it just used different language to describe the same thing. Justice Alito said that the majority standard, that is that harm must exist but it must not be significant, is just too vague and unpredictable a test, and that the lower courts had already sort of figured out how to do this well enough. And Justice Kavanaugh concurred on the basis that the discrimination is the harm, so proof of some other harm isn't needed. But he said he wasn't concerned about this disagreement with the majority because harm will always be satisfied under the majority's test, because if there's no floor on what sort of harm is, you know, enough, then it'll be satisfied by a loss of prestige, by inconvenience, by a loss of mentorship opportunities, by a loss of interest in the work. So he said, look, we reach the same point. If there's no floor on harm, harm is always found.
Very interesting. Now, GC, didn't you have an interesting article out earlier this week talking about how this decision could impact efforts to sue DEI officials? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that this case does in general is just make it a lot easier to sue your employer if they discriminate against you on the basis of any of the protected categories from the Civil Rights Act. That includes race, national origin, color, and sex, and religion. It's very popular these days for large corporations to use all sorts of discriminatory programming, whether that's employee resource groups, which are arranged on the basis of identity or hiring preferences or special fellowship programs or mentoring opportunities for people of one color or another. It became, with Muldrow, a lot easier to sue your employer for excluding you from those things or for putting you through mandatory DEI training. So I expect, you know, if people bring those claims, and they are, they will be much easier to win now.
Very interesting. Well, we'll put a link to your article in the show notes so everyone can take a look and read your excellent analysis of it. GC, who do we have for the interview this week?
This week, the interview is a bit special. It is one of the first times we haven't had a lawyer or a judge on. But this is a professor of Greek philosophy, Andre Archie, to talk about his new book called The Virtue of Colorblindness. Right after this.
5 days a week, two episode formats, one mission: to deliver the news you care about and analysis on the biggest issues facing America. The Daily Signal podcast brings you two episodes every day in the same podcast feed. Each morning, catch interviews with policymakers, leading experts, and conservative activists as we discuss some of the greatest challenges facing our country and offer solutions for a brighter future. And every weekday at 5 p.m., we bring you the top news of the day. These are the headlines you care about. Subscribe to the Daily Signal podcast wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss out on our morning interviews or evening news.
We are joined today by Professor Andre Archie, Associate Professor of Ancient Greek Philosophy at Colorado State University. He has published extensively about Plato and Aristotle, but also about how classical thought bears on modern issues. His latest book, the one which brings him to the podcast, is in that vein. It's called The Virtue of Colorblindness, and you can find a link in the description. Professor Archie, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, Professor, before we dive into the book, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? How did you get interested in ancient Greek philosophy?
So I am from Denver, Colorado. I was actually born in Kansas City, Missouri, moved to Colorado when I was one, and ended up going to Colorado State University. I ended up meeting a couple of individuals, but one in particular I mentioned in the book, Bill Hervey. He was a political science professor. He introduced me to the Greeks, ended up going to graduate school at Colorado State University where I work. And I just continued, fell in love with the Greeks. And just to go back just a little bit, you know, as I was growing up, a lot of discussions around the table. We attended church, a lot of discussions about scripture. You know, that sense of argumentation, sort of taking a position and defending it, that was always something that I was interested in, always very curious about, just language, et cetera. And so all of that sort of, I think, allowed me to appreciate what the Greeks have to offer. And so, yeah, so I specialize in Plato and Aristotle. I thought the topic of race would be a perfect way to sort of bring that classical tradition to the topic of race.
So let me return to that in just a minute. But to set the stage, the book is called The Virtue of Colorblindness. What do you mean by colorblindness?
So what I mean by colorblindness is the fact that race should not be meritorious. And so when we think about ascriptive qualities like race, in the past, we did assign moral merit to race. In fact, that has been an issue that we continue to deal with. But I think we were on a trajectory. We were taking seriously that tradition of colorblindness. And not just sort of in the American context in terms of slavery and segregation, et cetera, but the Western philosophical tradition speaks about character, which to me is synonymous with colorblindness. And we can get into this, but there are certain principles that support the idea of character. And I think one of those is that ascriptive qualities should not be meritorious. So to be colorblind is to say that race, it's not about race, rather, it's character. So character is meritorious, whereas race is not.
So this brings us back to ancient Greek and to the key word in your title there, virtue of colorblindness. I don't think that's casual word choice. Can you explain the source and why you picked it?
Yes. Yeah, so I picked the word arete, typically translated into virtue, sort of the excellence of something. And so I think that the approach to race can be done in a way that's appropriate and right. And in fact, can be excellent insofar as Americans can communicate with one another in a way that we all flourish in terms of race relations. So that was deliberately chosen, the virtue of colorblindness, because there's a way that we should communicate about race and the way that we should interact with one another regarding race. So I think that tradition of virtue, of course, it originates with Aristotle. There too, Aristotle speaks about relations among citizens in the polis. And so I'm trying to draw on that tradition to bring light to a new form of segregation that I'm seeing. And I hope my arguments are effective in sort of pointing out why that's so detrimental for us as a country.
Before we get into the critics of colorblindness, walk us through what is the virtue, the excellence that we can aspire to in the context of race?
Well, I think that it's important to realize that the American Project is unique insofar as we have a diverse groups of people together participating in this republic. And I think that we've been so powerful as a country, and we continue to be, because the individual is celebrated. That doesn't mean we don't have a sense of community. We do. But when it comes down to it, the individual is equipped with agency in order to engage in the democratic process. We can work with others, but again, the individual has agency to engage with the democratic process. So I think that what becomes significant is that these principles that define us as a country, constitutionalism, in a lot of respects, natural law, contracts, all the things that the 14th Amendment and the other amendments promise, but specifically as it relates to race, the Civil War amendments sort of embody those principles that are Western philosophical principles. And so, again, I try to bring those principles to bear on the topic of race, because ultimately we need to look beyond race in order for us to flourish as Americans. We can acknowledge the past, we can learn from it, but it's those democratic Republican principles that ultimately will steer us in a place that America will be better off by living according to.
So you argue in the book that not only is colorblindness under attack, it's probably in the weakest position it's been, fewest defenders, if you will, since the Jim Crow era. What happened?
Yeah, what happened? I mean, I think that many things happened. The most obvious thing that happened recently is the death of George Floyd. And so I think that really supercharged a lot of the discussions about race that was in the classroom, or that was discussed in areas that weren't really taken as seriously as they were taken once we had the racial reckoning, if you will, after the death of George Floyd. But when you think about those who are opposed to colorblindness, it's been around since the origin of our country. And so obviously slavery speaks to that. But even within the Black community, you had those who wanted to flee. I'm talking about in the early 19th century, the contemporaries of Frederick Douglass, people like Martin Delaney, Edward Blyton, James Holley. Each of these individuals thought that America was not a place for Black Americans. And that was the height of lynching. So, I mean, there was some justification for the way that they thought. They thought it was absurd to be colorblind. I mean, because America wasn't colorblind. And so you had many discussions taking place. Of course, I talk about Frederick Douglass. He ends up convincing some of those individuals that America is filled with promise, and our founding documents are instruments of freedom. So you had that aspect of the issue of colorblindness within the Black community. It's always been debated. It's still debated today. Then, of course, you have the relationship between Frederick Douglass and Garrison. I mean, this is why they ended up going their separate ways. I mean, Douglass was committed to the idea that the Constitution, our founding documents, the Declaration, all of that can be interpreted in a way that treats everyone equal before the law. Now, Douglass wasn't naive, but he recognized that it was important to read the Constitution, our founding documents, in a particular way, because it says specific things. We're not concerned so much now, according to Douglass, with the intentions of the framers, of the ratifiers. We're concerned with the actual words. And so the chapter that I deal with, the Constitution and Douglass, looks at some of what Douglass is doing in terms of Article 1 Section 2, Article 1, Section 9, then Article 4. But the larger story is that discussions of colorblindness, it's been around. It's been around for many years. And in fact, when you think about the recent ruling that outlawed affirmative action, Students for Fair Admission, and you look at some of the opinions, specifically if you look at Justice Thomas's and then you look at Justice Sotomayor, Justice Thomas points out an idea, or at least a movement, called anti-subordination. And so basically it's the view that the 14th Amendment, of course, forbids laws that discriminate. In the context here, the 14th Amendment discriminate against blacks, but it allows laws to help blacks, right? So this is what Justice Sotomayor argues. And so for her, the Equal Protection Clause can be used in a race-conscious way in order to achieve the goal of racial equality. This is just the opposite of what I'm arguing, just the opposite of what Justice Thomas argues. But that movement, that ideology of anti-subordination in terms of the 14th Amendment is quite popular. I mean, people might not know the term for it, but it's quite popular. The fact that laws can be used in order to correct for the past. And so laws must be race conscious. This is what Kendi argues. This is what Justice Sotomayor argues. This is what each of the individuals that I treat argue, especially Derek Bell. We can get into him. But right. But each of the advocates of DEI, anti-racism, essentially presuppose that, of course, laws can discriminate for the for the purpose of correcting for past discrimination, which are all antithetical to the American Project, but most importantly, antithetical to colorblindness.
So in addition to George Floyd sort of supercharging the ideas of Derek Bell and Kendi and others into the public debate, you also lay blame in the book at the feet of conservatives who you say went along to get along with a sort of comfortable racism is the phrase you use. Can you explain that?
Yes, comfortable racism, which is sort of a middle class exhaustion with the topic of race combined with, coupled with DEI or the teachings of anti-racism. So I think you have middle class Americans who truly believe when they hear anti-racism, they think it's something positive. They think it's something that unites Americans, and they don't realize that it's quite destructive. So I think comfortable racism is precisely that. There's an exhaustion. I think part of this is due to the fact that conservatives pretty much gave a fair hearing to, first, multiculturalism, which I think a lot of this sort of originates from. I'm talking about back in the 80s, this politics of recognition. That's ultimately what multiculturalism is. And it was quite negative. But that sort of morphed into many of the racial ideologies that we're dealing with today, DEI, et cetera. But I think that conservatives really didn't push back hard enough when it came to diversity. Now, there were certain policies that were initiated by Johnson, let's say, by earlier administrators in terms of enforcing Title VI and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 64. Some of that's legitimate in terms of, you know, making sure that discrimination is not an issue in employment. So I get that. But I think conservatives dropped the ball in terms of really calling out those who are anti-colorblindness, those who argue that to be colorblind is to be racist. I think that only recently have we gotten to the point where conservatives are really standing up and arguing for colorblindness. But I think, you know, that to be anti-colorblind is pretty much it has saturated the public square. Now, and feel free to jump in here, but you know, there were an earlier group of conservatives who were certainly opposed to any sort of civil rights legislation, even going back to 1866. Mm-hmm. People like Sam Francis, intellectual paleoconservative, he passed away in the early 90s, if I'm not mistaken. No, in 2000, I think it was 4 or 5. I'll have to check that. But in any case, Samuel Francis sort of represents a type of conservative that, and he even says that, he would abolish all the civil rights legislation going back to 1866. Now, I don't agree with Sam Francis. I think he's a brilliant man. I've read a lot of his work. So I think you have you historically there were some extremes. You had those conservatives, even Buckley to a degree. I mean, it took him a while to see the importance, or at least to see that segregation was not going to go quietly into the night on its own. Mm-hmm. That was his original position, and he had some other extreme positions which he eventually changed. And again, I like Buckley. I read his stuff. But I think, you know, conservatives, they haven't been as consistent as I would have liked. But I think now conservatives are seeing the detrimental effect of not taking the idea that we should judge people according to their character as opposed to the color of their skin. So I think just now, right, conservatives are starting to see that and appreciate that.
So you say in the book, you tell conservatives it's not enough to know what is good. You also have to stand up for it. What does that look like? What does that call to action look like for people who, like you and me, aren't, you know, we're sort of isolated, right? We're in a think tank in a university. We have a little more freedom to talk without fear of consequences, whereas somebody who, you know, works in a private office where their boss or the HR department is steeped in this color conscious anti-racism. What is the call, your call to action look like for them?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. And I don't have a silver bullet. I do suggest a few things in the book. I do think in states, and typically it's in red states, Republican run states, that you hold the purse strings, and for state universities, that's very significant in terms of what's being taught. So I think some accountability can be had there, and I think we're seeing that in certain states like Arizona, even in Wisconsin, of course in the South, and Alabama recently. There's been legislation that the governor I think will sign, banning DEI, et cetera. But that's sort of very limited to these states. On a very sort of pedestrian level, I would say talking to your neighbors, talking to school officials. It doesn't have to be necessarily in a public forum, but just sharing ideas that go against a lot of what most people feel intuitively are wrong. The fact that they're segregating kids in terms of their perceived privilege, you know, little kids, white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids. So I think that there can be an organic response in terms of pushing back against these racial ideologies. And it begins by just neighbors talking to neighbors, parents talking to parents, and of course, being active, getting engaged. We don't have to get in anyone's face necessarily. But I think that's where it begins. And I think that's where we will see change. I do think the recent Supreme Court ruling, again, is detrimental to the idea that we should judge people according to their race. I think that's a really good starting place. But just practically, I think that we need to start speaking up, be a bit more courageous. But I do think things are changing for the positive.
You made an interesting point in that last discussion about how people who, even if they won't say it, know it's some deep sense that it is right to be colorblind. And this would come, this would flow, I imagine, from sort of Aristotle's understanding of the nature of what of people and what excellence is. And that brings me to a really interesting point of your book to me personally, was that unlike so many other modern books about race and ideology, your arguments do not require data. I think you cite data once for the efficacy of the success sequence, and that's it. which is very unusual among most modern books about race, but it does put you in what I would consider kind of elite company, right, of older proponents of colorblindness like Frederick Douglass and MLK. Can you explain for us how and why do you make this argument without recourse to data?
You know, that's a really good question. I've never been asked that. Well, first of all, I feel like it's been done quite exhaustively by others. There are some who've done it quite extensively and better. I think Thomas Sowell comes to mind. You have people on the right. I don't always agree with them. People like Charles Murray. You know, there's lots of data from these individuals on the topic of race. But I thought it was important for me, in terms of my skill set, to speak also about my background. About my background in terms of my family, my formation, and the values I was raised with. And so I felt as if that was sort of the springboard for me to tackle the issue of race and the value of colorblindness and just the sheer humanity that we share as Americans, mm-hmm. not in a naive sense, because of course the other side always says, you know, to be colorblind is naive. This is what Nicole Hannah-Jones just argued, 10,000-word essay in the New York Times Magazine. But so it's not sort of a naive perspective. I think it's a human perspective. It's an intuitive perspective, recognizing. Of course, we see people's race, but there's more. There's more to individuals and groups than their mere physical qualities and characteristics. And we shouldn't be quick to judge. And so my skill set in particular was consistent with how I see the world. Numbers don't tell the story in the way that, you know, a point of view from a certain perspective can tell the story. And for me, that was from a sort of a classical perspective.
Would it be fair to say that your argument against anti-racism, CRT, is that it doesn't actually matter if their racially discriminatory policies would produce equal material outcomes because there's a higher morality at stake than material outcomes?
I would say you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I would say that, you know, even if we were to get everything, or at least those who argue that, you know, we need to discriminate for the basis of getting what's owed to us because it was taken away from us, that wouldn't make things better at all. It would make things worse, because I mean, there's a certain mentality that comes with that way of thinking, and that sort of mentality has nothing to do with agency, has nothing to do with bettering oneself to truly achieve a sense of equality in terms of how you see yourself. I mean, materially, that doesn't matter, but it's how you see yourself. That's why Frederick Douglass was so significant, and why the Columbian Orator, this little book, was so significant to me and how it formed him. He saw himself as a type of man with reason, and insofar as he saw himself like that, he was equal to any white man, he said, any white person. So I think that having something higher, a set of principles, a set of beliefs that are grounded in, for me, classical principles, is a type of equality that we're still striving for, and that's the ultimate equality that I think matters in the end.
Now, let me return for a moment to Students for Fair Admissions. And we were comparing Justice Thomas's opinion with Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson's opinion. What effect do you think that case will have, if any, on the debate over colorblindness in America?
Well, I think you're starting to see, Nicole Hannah-Jones, I don't know if you had a chance to read her piece. But
I did.
You know, she says basically, you know, the colorblind argument, it's won. It is won. And I think she's saying that sarcastically, obviously. But I think that colorblindness is ascendant. I really do. I think that we're starting to see a number of lawsuits across the country. And she rightly points out, you know, there's a number of them, and people are on notice. I think that's a good thing. I celebrate the very things that she decries and that she finds to be disheartening. I think that, you know, when you think about the 13th Amendment, you think about these, the abolitionist, or let's say the Civil War amendments. Mm-hmm. When the 13th Amendment, for example, was ratified, so let's take the 1866, the Civil Rights legislation. The 14th Amendment grew out of that, but it also had to do, obviously, with the 13th Amendment. And so, but it gave Congress the ability not just to abolish slavery or to reinforce the abolishment of slavery, right? So it doesn't reemerge, the black codes, all that, but also to do away with the relics and the badges of slavery. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about that, to me, that's so significant, because when you hear people like Nicole Hannah Jones and Kendi and Coates and Derrick Bell and Justice Sotomayor, when you hear these individuals, to me, they want to go back and highlight those relics and badges. They don't want to leave them behind. They want to make Black so exceptional, so synonymous with the past and slavery, that to me is just absurd. It's not that we're naive about the past, or I'm naive about the past. We can learn from the past. But the precise reason for the Civil War amendments is to do away with those badges and relics. Mm. And to me, that can only be done by treating everyone equal before the law. Blacks, Asians, white Americans. To me, that's true freedom. And to me, that's progress. And so, again, she decries the very thing that I celebrate. And so I think the recent case, Students for Fair Admissions, I think that's a good sign. And I think that's going to sort of accelerate, I hope, the idea that to be colorblind is to be American.
Well, your hope is infectious, because I have been feeling not particularly hopeful of late. When I look around and I see, I see judicial victories, but, judicial victories are always rear guard actions, because somebody has.
That's right.
Right, right. Which brings me to an unusual point, unusual in this sort of course of Supreme Court history, which is that the majority's decision, even though it is written by hyper-educated sort of intellectual elites, right, it is at odds with the prevailing beliefs amongst the cultural and intellectual elites. I have no sense, but maybe you have, of how does that fit into sort of the lasting impact of the decision and its repercussions for the rest of the country?
Well, I think that we have to make a distinction between elites on the left and elites on the right. Mm-hmm. I think there is a disconnect with elites on the left. I think elites on the right pretty much celebrates the decision. Pretty much embraces colorblindness. But on the left, you're right. I mean, there's a disconnect, especially in the universities. What impact will that have? I really think that universities, corporate elites, mainly on the left, I don't think that they take a lot of this stuff too seriously. I just think they put a finger up and they're figuring out which way the wind is blowing. I don't think they're truly committed to, let's say, affirmative action and sort of reviving it. I mean, I don't think there's anything like that out there. And all you have to do is look at California. I mean, they had opportunities to implement race conscious policies and they rejected it. The people. So I think that there's a lot of virtue signaling when it comes to administrators, academic elites on the left. I'm not sure how committed they are to the idea that we need these race conscious policies to help people of color, blacks in particular. Mm-hmm. So I think the ruling is going to have an effect. I think you're going to start to see these programs either go away, these race-conscious programs go away, or at least cut back drastically. They're going to cast a broader net. Arguments will become more class-based arguments regarding the working class, both white and black, Hispanic. I think that's the direction we're going in, and we need to go in that direction. I think that's going to solidify our belief in colorblindness as a country. So I think that, you know, there's some positive developments going on, although it's a rear guard battle, as you say. It's something that will reverberate. I think I'm a bit positive about the changes that are taking place.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. Well, Professor, before we let you go, we always ask all our guests the same question. I don't think I've ever had the privilege of asking this question to a non-lawyer, in fact, but here it goes. If you could talk to any Supreme Court justice, living or dead, who would it be and what would you talk about?
I would talk to Justice Thomas. What would I talk about? What would I talk about? I would just want to small talk with him. Talk about his influences. I mean, I've read his books, and I, you know, I know a lot about him. But just on a personal level, sort of a one-to-one, it would be nice just to get a sense of the person, the actual person, and of course, talk about ideas and his approach to law. But really, just sort of a friendly conversation about life. So, Justice Thomas.
A great answer. Well, Professor, it has been wonderful to have you on the show. I really enjoyed your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been great. Great questions. Awesome. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
GC, it's our favorite time of the week. Are you ready for trivia?
I sure am.
Well, with the court's decision in the GI Benefits case this week and with our recent trivia involving justices who are also veterans, I thought it might be interesting to look at other well-known cases involving veterans or veterans issues that the court has heard or has been asked to hear. So are you ready?
I am. Let's go for it.
Excellent. First up, this case did not involve the death penalty, but it was the first time the Supreme Court articulated its evolving standards of decency Eighth Amendment framework that has become, very controversially, so central to the court's death penalty case law. My question to you, GC, what is that case?
The case is Tropp versus Dulles, the infamous evolving standards of decency case. I don't know what the veteran angle is, though.
Yeah, fair enough, but well done. The case is Tropp versus Dulles, and the factual background is actually somewhat interesting. In this case, Albert Tropp was serving as a soldier in Morocco during World War II, and he briefly deserted his post, but was eventually picked up by military police, and he was dishonorably discharged. Now, a statute in effect at that time said that if someone was dishonorably discharged for desertion, that person would lose his citizenship. Tropp didn't know this, but he found out some years later when he tried and failed to obtain a passport. So because of that failure, he ultimately filed a lawsuit that made its way up to the Supreme Court, where Chief Justice Earl Warren, writing for the majority, found that this provision violated the Eighth Amendment and was inconsistent with the, quote, evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. So well done, GC. You got the case correct.
All right.
Now, next up is a case that the justices were asked to hear, but they ultimately declined to do so. In this case, the justices were asked to review the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals decision overturning an approximately $1.8 million defamation and unjust enrichment award in favor of this individual against the estate of the well-known American sniper Chris Kyle. So my question to you, GC, is what well-known public figure sued Chris Kyle for defamation?
I know this. This is Jesse Ventura. I think in his book, Chris Kyle, the sniper, recounted a story in which Ventura told him that the Navy SEALs deserve to lose people in Iraq.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Chris Kyle alleged that Ventura told him the SEALs deserved to, quote, lose a few in Iraq. And Ventura, of course, says this never happened and damaged his reputation, particularly because he himself is a former Navy SEAL. And so Ventura sued. Now, after the Supreme Court declined to review the Eighth Circuit's decisions, the parties ultimately settled out of court with the estate of Chris Kyle, and the case was dismissed. But well done, GC. All right, next up. In which case did the U.S. Supreme Court declare that the Stolen Valor Act of 2005 violated the First Amendment?
Alvarez versus United States, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well done today on this veterans trivia, GC. Now, stolen valor, for those who don't know, generally involves someone claiming that they served and received certain military awards when they did not. The Stolen Valor Act of 2005 purported to punish someone who falsely claimed to have received an award with up to 6 months of imprisonment unless someone lied about receiving the Medal of Honor, in which case that individual could receive up to a year behind bars. Mr. Alvarez claimed to have received the Medal of Honor falsely and was ultimately prosecuted for that. And of course, his case and conviction made their way up to the Supreme Court where it was overturned. Now, in the aftermath of this Alvarez decision, which came out in 2012, Congress passed and the president signed the Stolen Valor Act of 2013, which added the additional requirement that there must also be an intent to gain a benefit or something of value by fraud, in addition to lying about receiving an award.
Hmm.
All right, GC, a final question. Now, this isn't case-related, but I thought it was interesting, because the current marshal of the U.S. Supreme Court previously served as a JAG officer in the United States Army, ultimately rising to the rank of colonel, before becoming the 11th marshal of the Supreme Court. So my question, GC, who is the current marshal of the Supreme Court?
You know, I can see her face from all of the Dobbs leak media, but I do not remember her name.
Well, that's okay. You were spot on. Her name is Gail Curley. She's the second woman to serve in this position, and she became the marshal of the Supreme Court on June 21st, 2021. Now, as you just mentioned, she had to hit the ground running in the wake of the Dobbs leak. You might recall that the leak occurred only a month earlier when the Dobbs opinion leaked to the media. So the Chief Justice tasked Curley right after she was appointed to investigate, to try to find out who leaked that opinion, which of course she did not. But she has also been advocating, particularly to the governors of Maryland and Virginia, that these jurisdictions should enforce their relevant laws involving protesting and picketing at the justices' homes. So she certainly has a lot on her plate these days. But well done at trivia this week, GC.
Thank you, Zach.
Well, that's all we have for today. Thank you, everyone, for listening to SCOTUS 101. Please be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And as always, we'd appreciate if you left us a 5-star rating.
You can follow us on X at SCOTUS101 and email us at SCOTUS101@heritage.org with your questions, comments, or ideas for future shows.
You've been listening to SCOTUS 101, executive produced by Giancarlo Canaparo and Zach Smith. Sound designed by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Pop. For more information, visit heritage.org.